Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin working at a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And here we are. We're in episode number 47. And 47 is a prime number. It's the atomic number of silver. So I can't remember what silver is. Is it? It's not Jubilee, is it? Or silver anniversary. And don't forget the AK-47. That's a big military gun of some description, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The CH-47 is a Chinook helicopter. All military here for some reason. Now the Chinook with the two blades on the top.
Yeah.
You've got a P-47, which is a World War II plane, also called the Thunderbolt. Continuing on the Scandinavian phone dialing theme from last time, you can do that to phone Norway. They must have the same sort of numbers up that way. And the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn are located exactly 47 degrees apart. I suppose that's twice 23 and a half degrees, which is the Earth's tilt, is 47. And also as well, if anyone watches Star Trek, there's a large amount of references to the number 47 on Star Trek. And it actually goes back to one of the writers of the episodes was part of a club in a university in California called the 47 Society, and it's basically a society they've set up because they've they explore the phenomenon. This is the number 47, where there's an awful lot of random numbers that come up in nature, which comes to the number 47. I don't know too much about it, but you'll have to look it up.
Is it a Fibonacci number?
Oh, well, it could be, yeah. Yeah. But one of the Star Trek writers, can't remember his name, it was the Pomona University in California. Joe Manonsky. He was one of the writers, and he's got an enthusiasm for the number 47. It says here, as a result, 47 in its reverse multiples or combination of 47 occur large numbers of episodes of Star Trek and all the spin-offs. But there is something called the 47 Society, which you can look up. Kind of interested, I suppose. But that's it about that. We've also got 47 facts to come up next. But what have you been up to since our last episode then?
All right. I've been to another HPE event, which is quite interesting this week. It was at the Lee Valley Velodrome. So it was where they had the 2012 Olympics. Quite good. It was an interesting bit about it. It was a talk from the, is it Chris Hoy kind of thing? The guy who did
The cyclist.
He's at the velodrome. Yeah, so that was quite interesting. I'll put some photos up of me being there. And it's quite interesting. He did a kind of like a, what they call it, like a talk about, I don't know what the word's going out of my head now, get you up and going kind of thing. Motivation speaker. So yeah, it was quite good. He said, and you got his book, we all got a book of his copy of his book thing. So basically it was basically an HPE event at Intel. They released this new product called HP Synergy, which is their new product, their flagship product for the data center, which is a it's basically called composable infrastructure, which basically, you may have heard me talk about this in the past, blade enclosures. So it's like a big thingy. So you get racks, and inside your racks you get servers which you can put into like 1U, 2U, or you get the standy uppy ones, like the tower ones. But what you can do with a blade enclosure is, I'll put a picture in the show notes so you can have a look what I'm talking about. You can have multiple blades. The problem you've got, if you've got blade, normal 1U, 2U servers, when you put that into a rack, you've got to cable it all up. Where if you put a blade enclosure into a rack, so you get like five or six of these in one rack, you cable them once. So at the back, you cable them. So at the back of this server, you could, if you rotate it around, it's got like connections that go into the network, power connections. And when you want to deploy a new server, you come along and you just plug a server in. You haven't got to go in and plug all the cabling up. So the cabling can be really neat. But what these pictures are composable, this is the next thing along. So it's basically you have storage and compute and networking in one box. And then from the command line or from the API, whatever you're using, Ansible or Puppet, you can basically, from the command line or through a web interface, you can basically deploy machines for whatever resource you want. So you say, I won't want this kind of thing. It's basically like having the cloud internally in for your infrastructure. And it's just really cool. I mean, these boxes, you can have, if you can see the picture I showed you, it's got like loads of disks in it. So you can have loads of, I think it's like up to 40 2.5 inch disks in it. And then like each of those servers, you can have like dual processors, and like each of them can have 24 cores in it. And then you can have like each of those blades can then have like 2 terabytes worth of RAM in it. So you can just cut it up really easily and then destroy it kind of thing. It's basically called composable, because basically you can fluidly create and destroy servers, resources, how often you want.
So would you get a box of memory, a box of CPUs and a box of disks or something like that?
Yeah, so basically if you got that picture up, what I show you, you basically got, put in the chat. So you get that box of disks, and then you got these servers. So little things with like the silver bit on are where the disks, the RAM and the CPUs are. And it's all built into one box, and you basically just from one command line, you can just compose whatever physical server you want to create, basically.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So it's like having a cloud in your own rack kind of thing. It's interesting. So that's what I've been to. So it's basically it was an event to launch it to get customers to come to from HPE, and but the best bit, the marketing was quite boring bit, but the bit where we actually got to see this in action, and we get to talk to the techies about how it all works kind of thing, because like, it's quite interesting. It's like the back networking's like got 10. You give out 10 or 40 gig connections into it, and then so you can basically stack these up. So you can have like 3 or 4 in a stack, and you basically connect them together. And then the interconnect between the two is like 120 gig kind of thing. So 120 gig networking. And the other thing as well, what I'll put a link in the show notes to is. I know I was talking about Docker. We were talking a lot about Docker last week. One of my guys at work forwarded me to link to a couple of videos. You have to sign up for them, but you just have to get your email address now, so you have to pay for them. But a link about networking and how networking works in Docker and how that all works. So it's quite interesting. Like if you've got multiple hosts and how you cope with that. So that's quite interesting. I'll put a link in the show notes to that. So that's basically been my week. What about you guys?
I haven't done too much. It has not really been that long since the last episode, has it? But
no.
I've got a quick report back on one thing, and then I've actually got some advice to seek about another thing. Firstly, my newly made NAS drive has been working fantastic. I haven't... put a gigabit network card in it yet, but I do have one which is a slightly older one. But I might take Al's advice and cut off the cut the backing plate down a bit. and then maybe bend it over. You know, I might even bend it once I take it off. You never know. But it only didn't work once. And the Plex server bit's been working really well as well. So I've been made up with that bit. The only problem I've had with the Plex server is some of the formats of the video files that are put on it, it doesn't like very much.
I was going to ask you that, because you have to have quite a beefy processor, because it has to decode it. Basically, it's decoding it. So if you've got like something like, I want to say like a 120, whatever it is, bit video, and that's then compressing it into like web to watch through the player, you need a processing power kind of thing. Yeah. If you've got like a 10 gig video file, it's got to process that kind of thing. So
I've had some of the video files that I make are MP4s. Can't remember the bit rate, but they play absolutely brilliantly. But I was actually downloaded some of the we're going back to Star Trek again here, but there's a whole series of videos you can download from it's called Star Trek New Voyages. And it's kind of like a crowdfunded spin-off series of the original series that they make and they act in it and all that lot. And they've made about 12 episodes or something like that. Different actors in it and all kinds of stuff. And I downloaded them, and whereas they play perfectly fine on a computer, through the Plex server, all the sound's all off. I think it's down to video codecs and things like that. Mm-hmm. But that's just problems with the video files. But the actual Plex server has been working great, apart from one time when it wasn't connecting, and I thought, oh, that's great, it's not working now. And then I realised I hadn't switched it on. So that's a second good tip. If you want to get anything working, make sure it's switched on. And you've got a fighting chance then, at least. But yeah, that's been great. I haven't bothered with anything else on it yet. I haven't even messed with anything on it. I've just left it as it is, and I've been copying stuff on it, deleting stuff off, but that's been great. Now, the second thing, and it just was going to ask for some advice about, is encryption. Now, I know we could have episodes, hours long about encryption, but this is just a way to go rather than how it works, really. A quick backstory. One of the dentist office that I do work for, I've probably mentioned before, they got broken into. They went into the office. We tend to think it was just that. We tend to think they were just scallies. Quick translation for anyone who doesn't know: it's short for scallywag.
This is a surgery in Liverpool, then.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's close. It's by me. It's not actually in Liverpool, but I don't know. What's a down south version of a scally?
A yob.
A yob, there you go.
Maybe, yeah, I don't know. It's a bit old-fashioned, though. But
yeah.
Yeah.
So it was basically, from the evidence, it was just, that type of people who were breaking in, and they were just, picking up anything they could find. And one of the things they found was a portable hard drive, USB 3 portable hard drive. And he probably looked at it and said, oh, that looks all right. We can sell that. But the problem is, that was one of the backup hard drives from Exact and a load of other documents that they have. They have these backup drives on rotation, you see. And some of them are just normal documents. So if these people had looked at it, they would have been able to find out about patient records, read letters that have been sent from the dentist to the hospital. All these medical records and that. The likelihood is they've just sold it. It's been formatted and no one's even bothered looking at it. But it did get the dentist practice in a bit of a worried state, you know, that this kind of thing could happen, because there was also financial information on there as well. You know, that you know, people owe the dentist office some money, or they've paid in advance or whatever. So they've been asking what they can do about encryption, not only on the backup hard drives, but also on the towers as well. Because what if they broke in overnight and stole, you know, most of the towers have got nothing physically saved on them. But if the main server computer got stolen, and these people were after information, they'd be able to get it. So my question to both of you really is, what kind of encryption method would you have set up in an office like that, to prevent theft, or to prevent theft of information if it ever got stolen?
That's probably one for Al, but as far as I know, there's a encrypted file system for Windows. Is that right, Al?
You get a thing called BitLocker.
Oh yeah, that's it. Yeah.
So it only comes with certain versions of Windows, normally enterprise versions. Well, there's a number of ways you could do it, actually. So with Windows, you get a thing called BitLocker, with a bit for Windows Server and a Windows desktop. So basically what it means is you have a thing in the start in the computer called a TPM module. Did we talk about this the other week or not? Is it trusted something module?
Trusted platform module, isn't it?
Yeah. Which basically sits on the motherboard. And what happens is that when you can configure it either way, so that when you first turn on the PC, it either boots up directly into Windows, but what happens, you can either do it so you can also put a pin at the start of it, so when it turns on you have to put a pin in every time to start up it, or a password.
Okay, yeah.
Does that make sense? What it does is it does a special thing with keys. It puts a key into the TPM, but you have to have a backup of that, because what happens, if you ever use your motherboard, it basically obviously encrypted your hard drive. You never be able to encrypt it again. So what it does is that the TPM module is that it detects if the thing's been changed in the board, so that if they basically took the hard drive out and put it into another machine, because the key isn't in the TPM, they wouldn't be able to boot it up.
Okay.
So that's one way to do it. But then there's other products like Sophos do their own encryption, which basically does... What was that thing used to be called in Win? What used to be, I guess, is it TrueLock or something?
Yeah, I remember that.
TrueCrypt.
TrueCrypt. But I know that that's either not supported or not safe anymore or something, you know.
We don't know, do we?
I think it's not safe against the NSA, but it's safe against Scallies. You know, so you can still use it for and it would encrypt your stuff, but the NSA might be able to read it. But if it gets nicked, the likelihood of you know, a punter who's receiving a stolen hard drive won't be able to read it. You know, so it's trade offs. Like everything with security, it's trade offs, isn't it? So
So you can do it like that, or you get so you can do something like Sophos as a product. So there might be another third party. So that's the actual physical machine.
Yeah.
How would you plan? How do you copy the disks at the moment to the actual how do the files get backed up to the external hard drive at the moment? How do they get backed up?
Okay, so what they do is so in Exact, it's set up to, on exit of Exact, it backs up to E drive, which is the USB hard drive, so the Exact data gets copied
back
straight to that. That's how they do it. I think that's how they've always done it.
Yeah, that's scary. Taking me back. That's the way I thought I'd be backing up. Yeah. So basically, so you'd have to do a way of doing it. If like, because you get some thumb drive, don't you, when you plug them in, that it asks you for a password, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So you get encrypted. So I'm guessing you must. external hard drive people must do the same sort of thing. So when they plug it in, it asks them to put the password in. So that'd be a way.
Yeah, we did. We did have these external hard drives at my old place. Where I think it might have been like a keypad or something, and it was like hardware encryption like that. So,
but don't get, was it Wedgetail Digital? Don't get is it West Digital? They always moaning that they're really crap. It's really rubbish security, isn't it?
I would also think about off-site backup, like either CrashPlan, which is what I use, which would just automatically back up to the cloud. Actually, CrashPlan, you can do either CrashPlan's own servers or you can have a hard drive somewhere else talking to another computer with CrashPlan installed, and then it will just copy over to that hard drive. So that's one way of doing it. Or you can use S3 on Windows. I think you can get these utilities to talk to Amazon S3.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cheap as well. So you only pay for the actual data that goes in. You don't pay for storing the data. So it works out quite cheap. So that's probably a good way of doing it as well. But it's good to have it off-site, because then if it does get nicked, at least you've got the backup still.
So they rotate it at the moment.
They have a rotation, So they've actually got five hard disks. It's a bit like the old tape method, you know, where you'd use a different tape every day and things like that. So they have like five hard drives, I think it is, and some of them are at home, you know, with somebody. Some of them are in the office itself, and they bring some home with them and take some home with them. Because they've also got the... you know, it's all right encrypted there, and you say it's a trade-off, because they've also got the, if they do need that backup, then how, it's the speed of recovering the data. Because I think they looked at backing it up on the cloud, but the data that they've got is, just in exact, is 200 gigabytes of data in exact, which is the program that they use. So if they lost everything and they had to download it from the internet again, how long would 200 gigabytes take to download?
I have tried a couple of test restores from CrashPlan, and it's pretty slow. Well, I think it might be slow to actually do the initial bit of finding the data, grabbing the bit of data that you need is, you know, internet speed, whatever your internet connection is, I think. But then if you're doing it, I reckon that something like CrashPlan is just a layer over S3 anyway. So actually pulling it down from S3 should be fairly fast.
Yeah. I actually asked them whether, the method they use, or the program they use, exact, the database, is all locally held on a local computer.
Yeah.
And I asked them to call them up and ask them to see if they had a cloud version of what they were doing, for that purpose, because if they had a cloud version of that program, all the data would be held in the cloud, and Exact would deal with it, and Exact would back it up. And if the computers got stolen, they would not be able to access the data, because they're not on, it's not actually on the computer. But unfortunately, they don't do a cloud version.
Yeah.
But one of my estate agents that I do work for, they did have a locally based database version, and now they've moved to a cloud based version of the same thing. Because all has its good points, because they rely on the internet for that to work, of course.
Yeah.
But the good thing about having things in cloud, you haven't got to worry about backing it up, because that's their responsibility. Upgrading it's their responsibility.
Yeah.
It's running in their environment, it's their best practice. And then this. But if you say, if it goes down, you could have it so they have multiple internet, like multiple ADSL connections, or you could have, with the speed of 4G these days, it's you could have a router with a 4G backup dongle kind of thing. With a gift cap.
There's pros and cons with the cloud. I mean, it's at the end of the day, it's other people's computers, isn't it?
I want to get one of these t-shirts. I want to get one of those t-shirts. Yeah. Where it says like cloud, it says someone else's computer.
Oh, yeah.
Although, no what it doesn't say. Cloud. What it doesn't say is that there's these other people's computers are like in a data center with redundant power supplies, air conditioning,
yeah.
and all that. But then also with the, you know, accessible to the to whatever security agencies might want to have a look at it as well. Yeah.
It's not somebody's dusty towers stuck underneath the bench somewhere.
Yeah.
Unless you're using uTorrent, you know, that could be like that, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Does that answer your question, Andy?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of different ways of doing it. Yeah, I see what you mean. And I'd half remembered about that BitLocker, but I'd forgotten about it as well. So, yeah. But yeah, you're right. They do. So, it only works on certain versions of Windows, doesn't it?
Are they running Windows 7? I guess I'm running Windows 7, I'm guessing.
Yeah, they've got 7 Pro on it.
Yeah, I don't think you get BitLocker's Enterprise. You have to get... You have to have...
Oh, is it? All right. Enterprise and Ultimate.
Yeah. I think it's...
Okay, well, we'll look at one of the others then. But it's just something you need to look at and try and get something implemented, you see. So, obviously, they're a bit nervous about what's happened. You know, because you hear about, you know, politicians leaving a laptop on the train and
I don't know what the UK is, but like in America, they have that thing they're always going on about. They got everything's got to be encrypted, haven't they? They have lots of rules saying, if you've got customer data, and I can't think whatever they call it. I know Mike Smith's always going on about it in there.
Oh, I know the credit card one's called PPI compliance, isn't it?
PPI.
You can't get away from that.
Payment protection insurance.
I had a phone call about that today. I hung up. But yeah, PCI.
I can't remember what they call it in America, but there's something they always go on about, or you've got to be something compliant. So yeah.
Oh, SOX.
Yeah, so look at.
Is it SOX compliance?
Get it, what is
it? Sarbanes-Oxley, I think.
It's something like that, yeah. There's PCI compliance, and there's different ones as well for, you know, medical,
HIPAA.
Accountants.
HIPAA. So, but again, I bet if you go to a price and say, oh, you need to upgrade all your one from Windows 7 to Enterprise, they're going to go, no.
No, they're not, no.
Yeah.
I had to look at a PCI compliance for a client once, and it was basically a case of this version of PHP or whatever isn't compliant, so you got to upgrade it. But unfortunately, that was a bit of a nightmare because they had, instead of having CentOS or something on their server, they had RHEL and Red Hat Enterprise, and it was just impossible to get the actual RPMs to upgrade it. So it was a bit of an unachievable task, really.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's great. So I'll have to get back to them about all that. That's all I've got.
I think the sort of new version of TrueCrypt is called VeraCrypt, but I haven't heard a lot about it. So maybe look at that rather than TrueCrypt.
Okay, see what you mean. VeraCrypt.
VeraCrypt.
Yeah, I think it's just the fork of it, isn't it, kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
I don't know if Windows 10 come with encryption or not. I think like Windows 8.1 maybe you start getting the features. But I mean, again, it's just like if it's just a server they want to protect, then they're stored on the server. Then you only need to protect the. I'm guessing it's just a workstation. I'm guessing with the data on it.
It says yeah. It's not a. They call it a server, but it's not. You know,
basically Windows 10 machine.
It's Windows 7 Pro with a shared drive. It's not exactly ideal, but we've talked about that on this show quite a bit before, but it's just the way it is, I guess. It's funny because one of the locations, the server, is actually a workstation and they use it all the time, and the other location it's not. They don't use it all the time. It's a bit weird, but there you go. So I'll let you know about that. I'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I mean, apparently like there's the Symantec do one as well.
Right.
Encryption thing as well. So
I think the more bothered about, I mean, obviously they can come in and steal the towers, can't they? But
yeah,
one thing they've done already is put passwords on all the workstations. The workstations are basically they're like dumb terminals, really. There's no data saved on them. But they've also told the staff as well, every time they leave the computer, to lock it. Windows L, teaching them to do that, just in case a customer kind of leans over the desk and looks something up while no one's looking.
Yeah.
You know, and they had to change the password, which was conveniently, it was password. So that's the first thing they changed. So they've got a different password on there. And I was telling them, I said, the Windows password's useless, really, isn't it, for, for security purposes. It's all right for people, for that purpose of people, you know, you don't know what they're doing. But they've done that already, so that's one thing. But they were just getting a bit nervy about, data going. And, of course, they're an NHS sort of, well, a private company, but they're an NHS dentist, if you know what I mean. So they don't want NHS information getting leaked out and, you know, patient data getting shared around the internet, all this lot. So, so that's all it is. So, I'll be seeing them next week. So I'll let you know how that goes on.
Okay, cool. And Jerry.
Well, not a lot really this week. Just been getting into this new job and so on. Just something I found out today, though, was one of the data centres, they use Rackspace, and there's various ones around London. They call them LUN, L-O-N, LUN 3 and LUN 5. And I reckon LUN 5 is a data centre that I watched being built right next to where I used to work in Crawley. So it's on the industrial estate there. Apparently, it's one of the, you know, according to all the marketing stuff that I was looking up today, it's one of the most, modern, up-to-date data centres in Europe. So,
Cold aisles.
So there's some pictures. There was a slideshow, which I'll try and find and put in the show notes. I thought that was a bit of what's the word? It's kind of circular thing, you know. It's about half a mile from where I used to work, and here I am looking after infrastructure that's actually inside it. So I thought that was quite good. I had a bit of a WordPress issue with a freelance client. They're using X add-ons plugin, probably not known to anyone other than WordPress developers. But there was this little thing which I had to put in the w-config.php file, which is the main kind of configuration file for WordPress. I'll put it in the show notes because it doesn't make much sense to read it out on air, but the plugin wouldn't install, and it was given this generic error message about permissions. And the fix was to just add something in the w-config.php. So I will put that in the show notes. There's a Google appliance at work, which I've just spotted. Well, you can hardly miss it. It's like a
yellow.
I think a 2U server. Yeah, yellow. That you basically, as I understand it, you plug it into your LAN and it will go out and find any shares that are on the network that, I guess you give it permissions to access them and stuff, and it will index all your stuff on your network. So there was where I used to work, there was a Google search for internal documents. So I assume they were using that. Yeah, they were using that there. Looks interesting anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Andy, 47 is not a Fibonacci number. I checked while you were talking.
All right.
So there's nothing between, what's it, 31 and 55 or something? Seems like it should be. But there you go. And yeah, really, that's really it for me this week. Like you say, it hasn't been that long since the last podcast.
Does Rackspace provide racks, or is it basically they provide you servers? You don't basically bring your own servers. You basically buy servers off them.
I think they do all of that. They could do co-location, but yeah, mainly they just provide, you know, a server or a VPS or whatever.
Yeah,
and they also resell AWS stuff due to popular demand, I think. So I was talking to someone at the AWS summit that I went to a few months ago. I think they will either manage AWS stuff for you, or they'll just provide it for you with a Rackspace contract. Yeah. So, but yeah, they're just sort of another cloud provider. They're pretty good from what I can tell. You know, I've heard, one of the developers at my old place was saying that he got a Rackspace server and they just managed it really well. You know, they're always available. I think that their marketing spiel is fanatical support, which sounds like it could be a good thing or a bad thing. But apparently they're quite good at just customer support and doing the right thing. Although allegedly they plugged a firewall in upside down for the place I'm working for. So maybe not that great, but I think for their own stuff they're pretty good. So yeah, I did say allegedly anyway, so they can't sue me. That's it for me. Did you want to go through this job hunting recruitment stuff now?
Yeah, that's what we were about to talk about last week, wasn't it?
We're talking about obviously I've just changed jobs and I've just started working through my own company for somewhere. So I thought I'd go through that whole process. So it must have been about middle of August or beginning of August. Place where I used to work, we all got told that the service was shutting down, we were going to be made redundant and so on. So it's time to start looking for a new job. So that job, the job that I just got made redundant from, was I kind of found that organically. I decided I didn't want to... decided that I didn't want to stay where I was and that I wanted to move on. So some advice from a friend of mine was to post to this mailing list. It's called LRUG, which is the London Ruby Users Group. And so I put a mail out on there saying, I'm a sysadmin / DevOps person and I'm looking for work. And one of the Ruby developers that worked for Compose, which is that company that I used to work for, got back to me and said, oh yeah, we're looking for someone. So I had a chat with him, and then had a chat with the DevOps people from the agency that basically set up this app. They gave me a technical test which is basically set up a Rails server in Vagrant, and put the code to do that up on GitHub. That was it. And to me, that was just like another bit of freelance work. So I did that in 3 or 4 days. I didn't know how to do it when I got the sort of brief, but I went away and found out how to do it. And
all right, so I was going to say, were you allowed to use Google? Or were you just like sat in front of a computer and said, right, do it?
Well, yeah, that was sort of funny you should say that. I mean, this time, I did a few technical tests, and I said, you know what, I could solve this a lot easier if I could just search the internet. And they went, oh yeah, you know, we'd need it to do our job, so we wouldn't expect you not to to use the internet to look something up. So, but I'll come back to that in a minute. But so that basically got me the job, I think. I went for an interview on site with the people I was going to be working with, and they seemed to like me. And plus, it seems that there was a bit of a shortage of DevOps people at that point, and they'd been looking for ages to try and find someone, and they hadn't really found anyone. So so I got a job. But yeah, so fast forward to a few months ago, and so I tried that approach again, but really I was after a contract this time, mainly because money's better, you get more independence about what, you know, where you want, where you can work, when you want to work, and so on. But there's a flip side to that, which is it's harder to actually find those jobs. So you tend to rely on recruiters to do that. And yeah, that's a whole different kettle of fish, really. So so companies that that are after contractors really want people to just come straight in, know exactly what they're doing, have worked with these technologies before, can put things in, you know, they've got a lot of experience and so on. And importantly, they can start straight away. So, for instance, this one, the company, they interviewed me, decided they wanted to get me in, and they wanted me to start. I think I interviewed on Thursday, and they wanted me to start on the Monday. So that's kind of how fast it moves with contracting. But the thing about going through a recruiter is it can be they match your CV up. You put your CV up on something like CW Jobs or Monster.co.uk or JobSite. And they'll basically start matching keywords, so that, you know, they'll look up DevOps, and then they'll look up Docker, Linux, whatever. And if your CV comes up, they'll give you a call. They basically get paid per person that they place in a job. So I think they might even get a percentage of what your salary is. So they're kind of, what's the word, incentivized to get you at highest salary they can, or highest day rate they can as a contractor, and to get as many people into jobs as they can, because that's how they get paid. So sometimes you get 5-10 phone calls a day, sometimes you don't get any. So mm-hmm. It's not exactly stressful, because you're talking to people, and you this might be your next job. So,
sometimes sometimes they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah. And I did find that, like a couple of, one guy, I could hear him yawning as I was talking. So I was like, oh yeah, that's great. I'll just carry on talking, cause I might get a job. So it can be, you know, it's kind of not the best position to be in, really. And yeah, sometimes you get a call and you really like the sound of the job, and then you don't hear anything back. So you call the recruiter up again, and for some reason you can never get hold of them, which can be a bit frustrating. So I always try to get them to email me, because then I can send them an email, and at least it's less of a you know, you don't have to spend time phoning them, and so on. So yeah, maybe a bit of advice there if you find yourself in that position. Also, you get multiple recruiters phoning about the same job, because the job gets put out there to you know, many different agencies, and then loads of different people phone you about that job. So, and if you get put forward by one, then you can't. They can't. Another agency can't put you forward. So, you might have to end up having to, you know, just say, "No, I've already been put forward, and you can't put me forward." So, goodbye, kind of thing. So, but you end up kind of. You know, there's a sort of standard conversation that takes place. Hello, I'm a recruiter from such and such. I've got your CV in front of me about this position. And then either, I mean, what I'm saying now, because I'm still getting phone calls now, is that I wait for them to say they're bit, and then they say, I'm already in a position, so or in a role. So, yeah, so that's... There's a sort of standard conversation that takes place.
But you say about they get money for placing you, but you have to be in there for a certain amount of time, don't you? Because I know with if it's not like a temp job or like a contract job, like if it's like a permanent job, you have to be there like 3 months before they give you they get the money.
Oh, right, okay.
Okay, I think. So.
Yeah. I suppose that's just yeah. Part of their contract they have with the companies, because so otherwise they'd just send anyone there, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Do you do anything with LinkedIn? Do you change anything on LinkedIn saying, like, I'm interested in opportunities?
I don't know, actually. I had the odd recruiter calling when I was in work, but it was only when I put my CV on these job sites that I really got started getting the, you know, all the phone calls and so on.
Yeah.
I only really did that because I wanted a contract role. I got a few sort of leads for, you know, just applying for jobs for permanent roles, but no contracts. But.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was my that's my little bit about. dealing with recruiters, mm-hmm. It's a bit of a strange position to be in because, you know, for sort of a month and a half, you're kind of on this kind of merry-go-round of having a phone call, waiting for follow-up, and, 90% of the time it doesn't go anywhere, but it's that 10% of the time when you actually get the job, you know, and you
yeah.
just have to hope it's the right one, really.
Mm-hmm. So where do you go for these to put your name out there, like the job agency thing? Is that a job agency?
Well,
is it?
There's a few websites, CW Jobs and Jobsite, I think it's another one.
I've heard of them, yeah.
And Monster was the other one. I mean, I just Googled for, you know, DevOps, Ansible, you know, stuff that I know, and then... put my CV on those sites that had those jobs to begin with. So
what's the whole thing about contract with setting up your own company and everything?
Working as a contractor, I don't think you have to, but I think it's kind of standard practice to contract as a limited company, so generally a limited company with one employee, or you can actually, you know, you can employ a friend or your wife, for instance, either an employee of the company or a director. And then what you're doing, your company is doing the work for the company that you're working for, so you're not an employee. You're an employee of your own company, and your company is doing the work for as a supplier. Like, you know, it may be like someone who does the, I don't know, who supplies the vending machines or whatever. There's that sort of relationship, except it's not really. So that means that the employer, the company you're working for, doesn't have to pay for holidays. national insurance, because employers have, as well as you paying national insurance out your wages, your employer has to pay a certain amount of national insurance as well. And also none of the sort of benefits like that you might get, like pension or healthcare or anything like that. You don't get that as a contractor, but what you do get is more money, and quite a lot more money, probably enough to make it worthwhile. Certainly in my field, to do it as a contractor rather than an employee, which is kind of why I went for it in the first place. So as an employee of your company, first of all, as I mentioned, you get more money. You can be more tax efficient as an employee of your own company. What most people do is they pay themselves a nominal salary, and that keeps you, so you don't have to pay tax or national insurance as an employee of the company. And then you pay yourself dividends, which are basically the money gets paid to a business bank account rather than your own bank account that by the company that you're working for. And then you take a dividend from that money. Basically, you, from the business bank account, you just transfer the money. And that's subject to corporation tax rather than PAYE, pay as you earn, which is less.
So it works out, you take home more money, basically. Mm-hmm. Another aspect of that is if the company earns over a certain amount per year, you have to pay VAT as a lump sum to HMRC. But that also means you can claim it back on any business expenses, which as it stands, I can claim my travel, which is quite a lot per year, as a business expense. Actually, there's no VAT on travel, as I've just found out. But the thing is that you pay corporation tax on your profits. So your profit is your income minus your expenses. So the more that your expenses are, valid yeah. business expenses, the less tax you pay because your income is lower.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So it ends up you don't pay the tax on business expenses.
Yeah, so basically like if I had a job in London and it cost me $4,000 to get to London and back a year or yeah. whatever, I'd already paid that 20% or 40% depending on what tax bracket yeah. I'm on already. Yeah. Whereas with you're only just going to pay $4,000.
Yeah, that'd come off the profits of my company, and I wouldn't yeah. pay tax on that bit that's come off, if that makes yeah. sense. And with VAT, I was talking to a mate about this the other day, and I think we'd worked it out that only the end user pays VAT. So if you buy something, you pay VAT on it. But as a business, you pay a lump sum. So that you don't have to pay that. So if you buy something, you can claim the VAT back because only you don't pay it as a business. Only yeah. the person that buys the service at the end pays the VAT. So yeah. I think that's how it works anyway.
Mm-hmm. But that's only if you're VAT registered.
Yes,
though.
Yeah. Which is only worth doing if your turnover is a certain amount, which yeah. I think is about 80,000. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff to think about if you are going down that road. You've got to get the company incorporated to begin with, because then you get a number and you get registered with Companies House. You need that number to open a business bank account. And also you need your VAT number, which is a separate number. to put on your invoices.
If you're VAT registered,
yeah,
though.
Yeah. So when you invoice the company, you need that information on there. I would advise, something I didn't do was incorporate the company a bit earlier, because setting up the business bank account is apparently going to take another month or so. So I'm not going to get paid until December now. Or sorry, my company isn't going to get paid until December.
Because you can do other, you can do it another way, can't you? Because when I got an offer to contract job, I might have taken. You can call it called an umbrella company, isn't
it? Oh
yeah,
yeah, thing. Yeah.
So they do all that for you, and they take a percentage of it.
Yeah, but I've heard freelancers that I've spoken to are of the opinion that you should just go through the initial pain of, you know, setting up your own limited company, and then. Because I think the fees can be too high, or they can muck you around and stuff. But I don't know. That's just anecdotal. I haven't tried it. So yeah. I mean, I employed an accountant to do all the company incorporating the company and stuff. So again, I'm paying a fee to the accountant, but. Yeah,
but have you got to be careful though that if you're a limited company, you can't work for one company kind of thing. Yeah, they could say
there is this thing called IR35, which is kind of designed to. I think it's designed to make sure that you don't. Yeah, basically work as an employee. For the same company, you know, forever. To basically get around the tax. So
yeah,
I mean that isn't my intention anyway. I'm, as a contractor, I want to move around and, you know, work for different companies and get more experience in different things. So
yeah,
but there's very,
yes, Mr. Tax Man, if you're listening,
yeah, there's various things like you have to prove that you're able to send someone else in your place. I can't remember what the other things are, actually. Like when I got my contract, I had it checked by a company to make sure that I didn't fall within that IR35. So it's all about the wording on the contract. So if you get chosen by HMRC, they'll have a good look at your contracts, and they'll talk to your employer and stuff to make sure that you're not, you know, working as a permanent employee for a company, as a contractor. So that's another thing to think about.
Yeah, and the other thing you think about, if you're working for yourself, you don't get sick pay if you're ill or whatever.
Yeah, in fact, I had to take a day off on Wednesdays. You know, it's my first unpaid day off, really, for quite a long time.
So what about you, Andy, if you don't mind saying? So how do you kind of, how have you?
Okay. I'm quite simple, really. I probably should do that at some point, to the limited company thing, you know, what you've just been saying. But so at the minute, I'm just self-employed.
Okay.
It's just, there's no company involved. It's just self-employed. I've been like that for years.
So you basically just build that, and then at the end of the year you just do a tax return kind of thing.
Yeah, it's very simple, really. The other way Jerry's talking about it, and I know how that all works, and it's probably a better way of doing it for many reasons. And I probably should look at it myself. Somebody said to me I should do something like that, but I never have.
I think what you're doing is called sole trader, isn't it? So
yeah, sole trader. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's you're basically, yeah, you do a tax return, and like if your income, you pay the tax on what you've earned minus your expenses. Yeah. That's what I was doing up until I think the 6th of September when my company was incorporated, but because I had a permanent job. So I had to pay tax on whatever I earned, was kind of on top of what my day job salary was, and I pay tax on that accordingly, which is effectively about half. So about half the stuff I was doing freelance, half the money I earned was yeah. went in tax. So
yeah, I mean, I probably should. And there's loads of other benefits. I know there's downsides, of course, if you said to being self-employed or even your own, even being a limited company, there's downsides. But even a sole trader, you know, the if you look at per hour, you know, it's much more per hour than an employee would have in a regular job. But out of that, you've got all your expenses you've got to come up with out of that, haven't you?
Mm.
So that's the big difference, you know, when you have to pay for everything, really, don't you? That's where everything comes from.
Yeah.
And if you want to have, sick pay. So basically, in self-employed, there's no such thing as sick pay. You just, if you are sick for whatever reason and you can't get your jobs done, then you just don't get paid at that point in time. It doesn't mean, though, you know, I've been sick a few times while I've been self-employed. In the end of the day, for me, it's never really give me less money, you know, because if I've had, say, 10 jobs in over a period of time, and during that period of time I've been sick, then I've still got 10 jobs to do and complete, whether I'm sick or not. So, because the problem you have is you can't do it while you're sick necessarily, but when you get better again, then you're running around like crazy trying to catch up with what you haven't done, you know. It's another reason, another thing to take into account is things like bank holidays and things like that, like Christmas time and things.
Yeah.
Right now.
Holiday as well.
And what, sorry? Your own, your holiday.
Holiday.
Yeah. Right now, I've, not really monetary wise, but I've always got, you know, most people love bank holidays, you know, it's a day off. When you're self-employed, it can be quite different to bank holiday, because a bank holiday can be it's great the day off and, you know, you go and do something else or whatever, but a bank holiday can be a right pain, because say that week that there's a bank holiday on the Monday, I've still got the same amount of work to do during that week, whether it's a bank holiday or not. The only difference is you now have 4 days to do it instead of 5 days to do it. You know, especially if you have to, I mean, it's a bit different if it's remote, I suppose, but especially if you have to go and see people and things like that, you then now only have 4 days to do it instead of the five. So at the end of the week, you still get the same amount of jobs completed and same amount of money in, but you've had 4 days to do it instead of 5 days to do it. And of course, over longer holiday periods, you know, like the Christmas period, as well, you do tend to just not get any jobs in during that period at all. So you have to sort of plan for that, I guess, because during that Christmas week, in between Boxing Day and New Year, you basically get no jobs to do whatsoever. I guess because people assume that you are, you know, on your Christmas holiday or whatever. And of course, businesses are generally shut down at that point in time, so they're not going to be phoning you up. But when it comes back to January and everything's back to normal again, then you start getting the calls in again. So things that have gone wrong over Christmas, they haven't called you out over, but then that everyone calls you about it at the beginning of January, and then you're going mad busy again because they've all left it. So there's all things like that to think about as well.
Yeah, I think the idea is to kind of have enough in the bank to cover those periods where you're not, you're not working. Like,
That's right, yeah, because you could go, you know, if you were to say somebody, you know, you're not going to get paid for an entire week, you know, everyone would go, oh my God, you know. But that's one of the other perks of being self-employed, I suppose, or having your own company, is when you are working, you know, your hourly rate is more because of you have your own expenses to pay for and stuff like that than if you're employed. So you are getting paid more while you're working. But then that covers for times like that when when you haven't got any work to do, or it's holiday time and, you know, people are not available to do work. Businesses are closed, so you can't even go in and do anything, even if you wanted to.
Yeah.
And of course, family then expects you to do other things because it's Christmas holiday.
Mm.
You know, so.
Do you work with invoices? So.
I mean, not everybody gets one's invoices, really. You know, but certainly all the businesses I go to.
Mm.
All do invoiced, yeah.
Yeah, but then it's you have to, like, generally it's 28 days or 30 days payment term, so the company can pay up to a month later. So, I mean, for instance, if my bank account had been set up, I would be invoicing on, well, today or Monday, and then I wouldn't get paid until the 1st of November. But as it is, I'm probably going to be invoicing on the 1st of November, and I won't get paid till December, so...
Yeah.
So I've got to go. I'm not going to have any income for those 2 months. Granted, on the 1st of December, you know, it'll be a fairly good chunk of money. But up until then,
so it is plan in advance, you know. And I suppose ultimately, you know, you try and get a buffer.
Yeah.
You call it a buffer. So you could say at any point in time, you know. I don't know, it's different for everybody, I suppose, but let's just say a month, you know, or 2 months or whatever.
Mm.
At any point of time, you have, say, 2 months buffer.
Yeah.
You know, just in case, you know, your contracts are finished, you know, that line of work you're doing is finished.
Yeah.
Then you know then you have 2 months buffer, you know, where you can... You know, at least have some beans on toast every day,
yeah,
or something. just, you know, to keep you going for a period of time, of which you then can, you know, you'll be looking for different things to do.
Yeah.
So, that can also be quite important to try and keep, you know, that buffer.
I mean, I'm thinking at the end of this contract, because I'm sure my current employer won't want me. Because luckily, when I was talking to these recruiters and stuff, I didn't. The place was closing down, so I didn't really have anything to do. But at the end of this contract, I'm going to be talking to lots of recruiters again. You know, trying to get another contract, and I'm probably going to want to do that. You know, not while I'm sitting at my desk trying to get work done. At this place, so I'm pretty gonna have to leave a bit of time, you know, at the end for that. So have money to cover that, have income to cover that, you know, because bills will still have to be paid and so on. So
it is a pain, and there's so many good points and bad points to being employed and self-employed or whatever. To both of them, isn't there? You know, sometimes I think to myself, oh, I wish I just had a job that I went to and then came back home again, you know.
Mm.
And it can also be the grass is greener on the other side as well, can't it?
Yeah.
You know, when you're doing one
but it's
thing.
Just that, you know. But it's also that your own boss, isn't it, as well? You make the decisions kind of thing as well, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, that's all the benefits to it. Oh, people do say that you're your own boss. And actually, I disagree with that in a way, because... all of my customers are bosses, boss.
You've got more bosses.
So instead of having one boss, I've got hundreds of bosses.
They're not all
at me at the same time, because when I'm not doing any work for them, you know, you don't hear from them, you know, but the people that you're working
But what I meant more of that is that sometimes, like at my place, I think, hang on, we could have done that a better way if we did it that way, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I get overruled by saying, oh, no, we're going to do it this way.
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah,
that's what more kind of.
That's true. Yeah. On. Business decisions or ways of doing the job, or you know, you've got the answer to that. And on the flip side of that, you know, it comes down to you at the end of it. So you make that decision and it goes wrong, you know, then you then can't say, you know, oh, it was my boss's, he said to do that, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
That's another thing, but actually. So something that's written into a lot of contracts, like my field anyway, is that you have to have insurance. So I've got things public liability and indemnity insurance as a result. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So, yeah, so basically, if you go on and delete all the data, they can't. They can sue.
Yeah, they can sue me. They do your worst. I'm insured.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Cool. That's really kind of helped me out. What I wanted to talk about. Have you guys heard anything with XXMP before? XXMP, is it called?
Like XMPP, is it?
Messy.
Is that chat protocol?
Yes.
I've used Jabber before long time ago. Which is built on that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I've not done much with it other than that.
Oh, okay. I'll have to have a look into that. Because they were talking about that on the system administration podcast, about that's how they get messages about alerts
and stuff.
XMPP, sorry. Oh, I did it wrong. It's XMPP, kind of thing. No, why?
Yeah, I think a friend of mine had it set up for his alerts, and I was getting it through Google Hangouts. I think Google Hangouts, you know, the chat thing is what it uses in the background.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, two things, is it? Well, we've got three things, actually. Geeksters is back on the air. I don't know if you heard a couple of their episodes.
Yeah. I'm halfway through one of them.
And apparently Prodnuts Pro is going to be back, apparently, as well. So it's one of the podcasts which I wanted to kind of, that's what maybe wanted to do this podcast in the first place, kind of thing. So.
Which one's that? What's the second one you said then?
Prodnuts Pro.
Oh, right, yeah. With that was a brilliant one, that one, yeah.
The guy who did it was kind of always had stories to tell, kind of thing.
Yeah, so, what's his name?
Matt Rainey,
yeah. Oh, that's great if that one's coming back on again, yeah.
Also, I've kind of been doing a bit of binging on Vim this week. Created a Vim cheat sheet, mainly for myself, but anyone else want to use it. Basically, go to admin podcast.co.uk. /vim/, and that basically brings up my little Vim cheat sheet. Basically, I didn't realise. I know that HJKL. I still can't get used to that.
No, I still go to the arrow keys rather than that.
I still can't get used to that kind of that one line thing. I get confused. Is it one's up and down kind of thing? So.
Yeah, JK. I think Vim Adventures is good for that. Yeah. Well, I should add some stuff to that, because I've got a few bits to a few more tips there. So
cool, yeah. Because I don't know, inserts new line. You can basically and I was getting really confused about deleting escaping keys, because delete gets a bit confusing if you're in the editor mode or insert mode, and then you get out of it again. But apparently, if you kind of like just not in insert mode, only insert mode when you want to go in insert something.
Yeah, only if you want to type something out. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you want to delete something, just come out of it. And then if you press X when you're on the cursor, or remove it kind of thing. And you can write delete lines, or like DD or DW deletes a word kind of thing. So add stuff to that.
Yeah, well,
it's just quite a good thing to, like, if I'm working in Vim somewhere and I'm like, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to pretty forget it, because I'm not like you. I don't get to go in Vim every day. It's only like once a week or something. I'm going, how do you do that again kind of thing? So...
Yeah, good thing maybe is to get a few plugins if you're using Vim on one machine. Because you can do things like there's special things to comment out lines or put, say, quotes on around a block of text and things like that. Mm-hmm. Just all handy plugins like that. So.
Yeah. And also, apparently, you can do /, and then you can type a search term, and you can put N, and it'll basically go through the next occurrence and everything.
You can also use up and down in that mode to do, you know, go through the history, like as if you're on a terminal. And so N goes lowercase N goes forward, uppercase N goes backwards.
Okay. And then we had an email in from John Nice Guy.
Yeah, John the Nice Guy.
We need to get him back on, actually, because we did do an interview with him after Odd Camp, but then he had to go to call, wasn't it?
Classic, so. You know, sysadmin problem there.
Yeah.
So shall I read it out? Or, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because you probably know about it more about it than what we do.
I can't find it. Have you got it there? You read it out.
Yeah, I got it. John says, are you aware of Hacktoberfest? Contribute full pull request to any GitHub project, including documentation, unit tests, or even shock horror code, and get a t-shirt and stickers. Who could resist that? It's a great idea for getting people dipping their toes into using Git and potentially into contributing to open source projects. I won it last year, he says in inverted commas, as in I completed 4 PRs, pull requests, and got the t-shirt and stickers. And I'm entered again for this year. All the best, John the Nice Guy Spriggs.
So he's literally done it and got the t-shirt.
Yeah, been there, done that, got the t-shirt.
Can we do an episode on that next time? Can that be our next episode that you can talk about Git and what it is and how it and actually demonstrate how it actually works? I think I've got in my head what it does, but it's like containers. Like when I start playing with it, I want to understand it kind of thing. I think if you show us how to do it, then it'd be quite.
Yeah, cool. It's just great for just code, using code. In fact, it's pretty much the only version control system I actually know. I did look at Subversion, and in fact, we're using it at work, Subversion, but hardly anyone uses it anymore. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. Could we try that and do a screen share and put that on YouTube like we did with the last one?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, I think
try
so.
Try that. Yeah. That's it. And in case no one noticed on the last episode, there's a bit of a YouTube video up, isn't there, about what we talked about in the last show?
Yeah.
So we can check that out.
Okay. I think we're. I actually did present the things on the actual, put out the things on the, I basically put out the show saying it's live on the Google Hangout or the Google, on the old social media. So I'm going to try and put a bit more out on there now kind of thing, if I want to get some information kind of thing. So, yeah, so I think we're about there. We've done quite a long show today, so been good.
Right. So, we've gone way over the hour.
Good. Okay, we'll speak to you all soon. Has anyone got anything else to say?
That's it from me.
Check out all the social media stuff and the YouTube channel and Facebook and Twitter and everything.
And follow John the Nice Guy's example and mail us at mail@admin@podcast.co.uk.
That's great. Cool. Excellent. Well, I'll see you all next time then.
Speak to you all soon.
Bye.
Bye now.